Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor, joined by Ann Thompson outside at the Telluride Film Festival back in the mountains of Colorado. It feels good to sit here with you, Ann, and talk about movies, even though we've been in person for a couple Screen Talks since the world turned upside down, because Telluride is a unique experience. It's intimate, it's personable. We watch a shitload of movies over the course of Labor Day weekend.
And but we also see a lot of people. We went up to the brunch, which is the opening day ritual. Everybody piles into a bus and goes up a windy, scary road up to the top of a mountain. I got to hang out with my traditional seatmate, Eugene Hernandez of the New York Film Festival.
And I sat with some Sundance folks who were scoping things out for their edition in January, because each time one of these things comes around, everybody's trying to figure out, well, how does it work? We did Cannes. That was a wild, chaotic experience. This is different.
Now, we talked about this a little bit before, but the story has developed a tad. So Cannes was a live film festival. The market was separate. It was virtual.
Decision. It was virtual and physical, but nobody did the physical because of virtual.
And then the movies that played at Cannes were also up for sale, and people were there, you know, looking at them. But this festival is live only, and there is no virtual component, although of course we've been given some links and some screenings before we got here, which is why it's possible for someone like David Ehrlich, our chief film critic, to actually appear to be reviewing one film after another.
Right. Yeah, it wasn't just like he's got two brains or something, or we cloned him. But I have to say, the other thing about what you're pointing out here is that one thing you realize when you're on the ground at a place like Telluride is that you couldn't do a virtual version of it. It wouldn't work online. It's so specific to the nature of the audience. It's this intersection of some regular folks who have just been coming here. They buy the badge and they just come to the festival and they're not in the industry. You have Academy members who are here just to watch movies for fun.
Some of them didn't come. You have patrons and you have industry people and media people. I will say that there are fewer people here than usual. The screening rooms are not packed to the gills with people turned away. I would say that not even the one we just went to, which was probably the most in-demand screening I've been to so far, which was King Richard, because there's big word of mouth on it.
They weren't turning people away.
No. I think everyone gets into every screening now.
Well, I'm not complaining about that. And there's still something like 50 media people technically here from what I hear. So I think it's something like 20% drop off from what they've seen in the past, which is significant. But this has always been sort of this exclusive festival, right?
Yeah,
so it is kind of working. And we're seeing movies that seem to work in a Telluride context. I mean, let's get into the movies we've seen so far, because you could tell that the festival is doing basically what it's designed to do from an industrial standpoint.
So the opening night was, forgive the expression, a clusterfuck.
Yes.
It was
a bit
so
of a pancake.
Impossible.
To put it in gentler terms.
Because, you know, we want to be first. You know, there's three of us here. But there was the Peter Dinklage tribute, which was going with Cyrano, which is the Joe Wright musical that is really very, very good and a wonderful launch pad for Peter Dinklage as a best actor candidate.
It's an Ann Thompson kind of a movie, as we said in line earlier.
Yeah, I was making fun of myself, but it's true. I'm an Anglophile. I'm a Joe Wright fan. Joe Wright, this is the movie he was born to direct, because this is the period. This is the guy who did Atonement, Anna Karenina, Pride and Prejudice.
Certain Netflix movie that will not be mentioned.
A Woman in the Window. He's recovering. He was licking his wounds.
It's a good bounce back.
And so he went to see his wife, Haley Bennett, who's a very gifted actress. with Peter Dinklage in this show that his wife Erica Schmidt was doing. This, there's a couple of husband and wife teams involved, and he decided that he would try to turn it into a movie, and he shot it during the pandemic on this remote island in Sicily.
Yeah, which makes sense because when you look at
village
it,
village on the island of
Sicily, it's quite a vacation kind of a production. Everything looks like it's almost like a Mamma Mia type of backdrop in a way. Everything looks very romantic and art directed to a fault, which is what Joe Wright does well. But also the music was written by The National, so it's almost like a pop rock kind of a thing in the context of this 17th century, you know, swashbuckling wordsmith character that Dinklage is playing. And that's what's fun about it. I thought it was pretty silly in parts, but I did enjoy what Dinklage is doing.
A very moving performance. Not wearing a long nose, you know, the whole point of Cyrano was that he didn't feel worthy of the love of Roxanne. And so there's some depth to this that's very moving.
And Dinklage has been doing this since The Station Agent, as the tribute that they did for him tapped into, which is basically playing these characters where it's not exclusively animated by the fact, by his height, but there's something that often goes unstated, which is that he's ostracized. He can never be fully accepted as the person he wants to be. And here, you know, he's in love with this
it's
woman.
It's overt here.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like the entire. I appreciate it.
Yes. It's very beautiful and it's very well done and very moving. And at the end, there's a sequence. I would also say the music isn't. It isn't like Annette. It is not operatic. It isn't one of these things where it's wall to wall sound. I will give this movie an A, and Annette a D.
Oof,
and,
that
in
is
the musical
quite a
universe. And it's partly because Joe Wright is in complete control in a way that I don't think Leos Carax was.
Well, but
it's also more the love story, the sincerity of the love story, than the music is expressing the emotions in an organic kind of way.
Yeah, but I mean, Cyrano is a movie that is willing to be sentimental, and Annette, because it's Leos Carax, would destroy himself if he had a touch of sentimentality into the movie. So they're fundamentally different experiences. But it's a fascinating point of contrast in a year when we are swimming in musicals, and this one could actually do pretty well for MGM.
I agree, and I think that the Academy will go for it because it's got crafts. It's got production design, costumes, some music. It's got a lot going, and the actors will love it. So let's move on. The other movies.
So much stuff.
So King Richard was playing last night, also. So this of course, we've been hearing buzz about how Will Smith is making a very, very big comeback here as and another Best Actor candidate.
Oh, absolutely! I think he may even be some kind of a front runner, looking at what this movie is, because playing Venus and Serena's very dedicated, very overconfident father is one of those gambles where at first obviously you see the actor and you know him and he's playing a certain kind of kooky type, but he gradually makes the case for who this person was. And then in the credits you see the documentary footage of the real Richard and you realize how accurate the performance is.
And the director, so I love this story about how Jada Pinkett Smith, this is a project that was being developed by Will Smith and his wife and their production company.
Yeah.
And she picked up on this director.
Yeah, so Renato Marcus Green, he's a part of a sibling filmmaking duo. His brother, his older brother, Rashad Ernesto Green, has also made some movies, and they make indies. And
that's what I was thinking of earlier, by the way.
Yeah,
I had liked his work earlier as well as Monsters and Men.
They have actually sort of a similar kind of naturalistic style.
Yes, yes.
And it may be in part because Ray has said that he, you know, took a lot from his older brother. But Monsters and Men went to Sundance in competition a couple years back, and Jada was on the jury. And that was a movie that actually really resonated for people last year because it was it had a sort of a resonance with the George Floyd situation. So a very tense story about police brutality, but also just very well, very engaging kind of story in the sense that it had both the emotion, but also the kind of the directorial intensity of somebody who had a real vision for it. So it wasn't just falling back on sentimentality. And you can see that coming to bear here, and that makes sense that Jada would have said, well, this guy might be the person you need for this movie, because actually Julie Hunsinger, the director of the festival, was right when she said it's both a kind of big family movie and it's sort of an art house movie. It can work for a couple different
say art house. I would say it's a crowd pleaser, a mainstream movie. I think it's going to be a huge hit with the African American audience.
Well, that's
huge.
A no-brainer.
And I think it could be a theatrical hit. It plays really well. And it has an authenticity and feels like it just rings
true.
But
that's the art house element, is what I'm saying, is that it is, there is something cinematic to the way that he has directed a movie that is within a familiar mold, but it moves in a very organic fashion.
But it's still, you know, upping the stakes all the time and making, you know, manipulating the audience with a certain kind of very mainstream soundtrack. I think critics are going to be very positive, but it's not like it's going to be on the 10 best lists at the end of the year.
It's a hard movie for that to happen with, because critics tend to not.
But it doesn't matter. As far as Oscars are concerned, it doesn't matter. It's going to play really well. So Belfast is what I went to last night. It's the
another comeback.
Branagh.
This one perhaps behind the camera.
What's interesting about this guy is that he's an actor first, and obviously a great Shakespearean actor, Kenneth Branagh.
He's got a huge filmmaking body.
But he started out with really good indie movies that were really, I've always respected him as a filmmaker, and you know, for him to pull off Thor was a big deal.
It was, but a little self-serious, but
sure, but he's
he
done
teed up Taika.
He's done a lot of Hollywood stuff, and I think he needed so during the pandemic he took the opportunity to dig into a true story from his past, which was the pivotal time in 1969 when he and his family were experiencing the troubles in Belfast,
yeah,
in Northern Ireland, and what happened. And it's black and white, and you could compare it to Roma.
It is his Roma. I mean, I think like every filmmaker now who has a certain substantial body of work wants to make their Roma at some point. And it's not only is it black and white, but it's so clearly about his experience as a childhood in very specific ways, his relationship to his grandparents, watching these movies.
Karen,
like Chitty
Hines,
Chitty Bang Bang.
And Judy Dench are really charming. I mean, unbelievably charming. But so are his parents, played by Katrina Bafe
of Outlander
fame, and as well as Jamie Dornan, who was very good.
Jamie Dornan, which I have to say, it is funny how last year nobody was really talking about Barb and Star and how funny he was in it, but that guy has range that is hiding in plain sight. I think the thing about Belfast is, again, I mean, maybe it's Kenneth Branagh's Roma. It's not sophisticated
Roma.
In the same kind
exactly.
of way. It's very straightforward.
It doesn't take as big a swing.
Yeah, but it is.
It's a smaller picture.
It is involving. It's very well acted.
It could have gone into more depth about the actual context.
Well, but it's a kid's point of view. I think that's that part of it I actually appreciate.
So it's more like Minari.
Yeah, Minari is another point of view. Everybody's trying to capture the children's POV on the adult world these days. Spielberg did it first, but he doesn't have a monopoly.
Now, did you see Come On, Come On?
Haven't seen Come On, Come On yet, so we'll have to report back on
that. So
that
was last night,
those
too.
Were all on top of each other, but that's the thing.
And then there's some movies that are playing catch up for people. A Hero from Farhadi was last night. And Fauci, very good.
Yeah, so there are a couple of docs now that are
making Cow and Cannes.
Cow, the Andrea Arnold movie. Unfortunately, she was one of a bunch of people who couldn't come. Flea is making a comeback after winning Sundance. So that's been a big gap. That movie was bought by Neon at Sundance, and that's a pretty significant
one. It's a great movie, and it's going to be, yes, it's going to be playing big. It'll end up in the doc race, I'm sure.
International.
And it'll end up in the international race.
Don't forget about animation.
Is it Denmark? Is that?
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
So if you get all three of those,
yes, exactly.
Does
right.
that put it into the best picture category
or two? No, it doesn't.
All right, well, I'm throwing it out there, because what the hell? It's Telluride.
So the Rescue play last night, you got to talk to the filmmakers.
Yeah, the Ty Cave Rescue movie. I would say,
Australia.
I mean, the challenge with that movie and the story behind it, which is fascinating, is that they couldn't do what they did with Free Solo and be there for the action, so they had to figure out other ways to do that. So it does have a lot of reenactments, but the reenactments were done with the divers in a cave.
So I spoke to one of the divers yesterday,
and
he said it was in a tank at Pinewood, and that they actually borrowed some set from some other big budget action movie and used it, and so they recreated these sort of torturous cave swimming experiences. But there is a lot of reenactment.
There is, but I think what's fascinating about it is that I followed this story so closely, like it was a movie when it happened, and there's so much that we didn't know about the moment-to-moment risks, how they talked about anesthetizing the kids and the fact that they thought that wasn't going to work, and here's why it probably wasn't going to work, and it shouldn't have worked, and you really get get that, and it is.
They got them
intense.
All out, and you. It's a nail biter.
It is very.
It's, but it's also beautifully done.
Yes.
And very suspenseful. They did a good job.
So there is also we have to acknowledge the fact that Venice is going on right now, and we're not on the ground there, but we are sort of experiencing echoes of it from afar. We'll get a chance to talk about Power of the Dog later.
We'll see it on Saturday because they're going to be wending their way. It already got rave reviews in Venice. So Jane Campion and Benedict Cumberbatch and Kirsten Dunst will be here joining Cody Smith, Big Fee. You got to see Spencer already.
Spencer, yeah.
So that broke now.
I did, yeah, and that has broken, and it's coming to the, they're going straight from Venice to here. So that's going to be one that I think will be really fascinating to talk to you about once you've seen it, because like the Will Smith movie, you have this very recognizable actress, in this case, Kristen Stewart, playing somebody who is very well known, Princess Diana. But what Pablo Larraín has done is created this very sort of boiled down psychodrama. It's all one location, and invented a whole bunch of stuff about the weekend where Princess Di decided to get divorced and leave the family. So it's this fantasy, dreamlike thing that is not what anybody would be expecting, and it's certainly nothing like The Crown. So I'm really excited to see how people talk about it. It's a beautiful movie, shot on 16mm.
I can't wait to see it. It'll be here shortly.
Her performance is the thing that I think people will be really excited about.
And then the other one is Becoming Cousteau, which is Liz Garbus, who you all remember from What Happened to Simone, the Nina Simone jazz documentary. So in this case, she's dealing with Captain Jacques-Yves Cousteau, who you may remember from your childhood, from all of those TV series. And he, with his little red cap and the calypso and everything. And so she really uses this extraordinarily rich archive of material, because he was a filmmaker himself.
Yeah.
So she could get all this stuff to use to tell the story without talking heads, with a lot of audio of him, his wife, his kids, and his transformation from someone who was basically exploiting the sea and enjoying it as an explorer, because he worked for the oil companies. That's what funded a lot of the films. And then he switched over to TV, withdrew from the oil companies, understanding that they were ruining the sea. He was watching the sea he loved be destroyed, and he became a real environmentalist. And that it's a very, very good movie. I think both The Rescue and Becoming Cousteau could be big players, along with Flea, in the doc race.
Well, as you pointed out, what is it, 19 docs here, 18 docs?
18 docs.
So, I mean, it's going to be a competitive
season.
And four
from Nat Geo, all of them good. The Fauci is from Nat Geo, and Fauci's very good.
They leaned into that opportunity that they saw, which was to come to Telluride and make a big impact after the last time they were here, or was it with Free Solo. So I think that it's pretty big deal to think about, you know, everybody sort of revving their engines for an award season that is still tainted by the pandemic, but is perhaps not quite as hampered as it was before. Of course, the Academy itself is not here. They're not doing their usual thing because they chose not to come. So Telluride itself took it over, but it does feel like there are Academy members here, and the Telluride effect.
They don't need to be here. I mean, it's about what we write and other people write, and how the different movies come out of here with a certain kind of cachet and buzz. And we've talked about this in the past. Venice builds some profile that sometimes it gets continued to Telluride. Telluride builds a profile, it gets continued at the Toronto Film Festival. Toronto builds a profile, it goes on to New York. Something like Parallel Lives, which was the opening night in Venice, is going to go on to be the closing night at the New York Film Festival. Now, the New York Film Festival is live with no virtual, and Toronto is hybrid. And they're not letting us see a lot of the films. So.
But we'll get to see what we need to see.
So Sundance is the one where they're going to try.
For hybrid.
To do hybrid, and it's going to be interesting to see if they can pull it off.
Well, I think that there...
Because it's the distributors and the talent who are demanding live screens.
What we've learned is that hybrid can work in certain contexts, but as I said earlier, there are certain ways in which you need the physical, right? And you look at the way Venice is playing. Like, people are posting the standing ovation. Even Kristen Stewart stepping off the boat.
I know,
onto
I love
Lido,
it. I can't get
that's
enough.
That's part of the campaign for that movie, right? It's already started. And then they get on that jet and they come here. I think there's such an obvious complementary nature to the way festivals play a role in this ecosystem, both for the Oscar players, for the distributors, for everybody.
Oh, the
you
other
can't
docs,
replicate that online.
The other doc that Kate Erblend reviewed for us, or no, maybe it was Kristen, somebody reviewed it at IndieWire, and I disagree with their review because it's
wait,
like...
Wait, what movie are we talking about?
Julia. So Sony Pictures Classics has a few films here, and this one is from the people who made RBG, and it's Julia Child, the great chef, the popular chef, the television star, and it is an escapist romance, and I'm not going to make claims for it as the greatest movie documentary ever made, but it's actually really fun and sensuous and delightful and kind of an escape from a lot of the craziness we're living through right now.
Well, I haven't seen that one. The escapism that I've seen at Telluride, which is completely outside of the paradigms of Oscars and all that stuff that we've been talking about, is Marcel the Shell with the Shoes On.
which, I missed that one.
Some people may remember. It's this Jenny Slate viral video from like over 10 years ago. And this filmmaker, Dean Fleischer Camp, and her, what they do is she does this high-pitched voice for this adorable little character that's a talking shell, and they actually made this mockumentary about Marcel, who's this cute little shell but also lives in this empty house, and you gradually figure out there used to be more shells and they vanished and you don't know why. Marcel's life is actually kind of sad and lonely, and it's a good little stop motion movie that is doing things on obviously, you know, in a very resourceful way to tell a fantastical story, almost like a shoestring Pixar kind of effect. And I think it's the kind of movie, kind of like when The Assistant was here in 2019, that could then maybe get a distributor and resurface at Sundance. It's not going to come out. There's no reason why it would come out this year. It's a small movie, but it will resonate for audiences here, and there's some folks around here who are promoting movies they're going to put out who might see it and say, oh, next year I can do something with this. So it's always nice to have those smaller kind of discoveries as well, because that's also a really important part of this festival. So,
well, the other thing we're dealing with here, this is one of those beautiful places in the world, and there's various outdoor events going on. We were spared the rain at the brunch, but it's raining on us right now.
Just a tiny bit. It's a mountain weather. It's so unpredictable. But we've got a long weekend ahead of us. I mean, they added a day to the festival, I guess, to kind of make up for lost time. And there's a lot of movies, over 80 movies, they've said, including some sneaks. And who knows what else might develop. But we've still got to see, like you mentioned, Come On, Come On, the Mike Mills movie with Joaquin Phoenix. We still got to
see The Duke, which was supposed to be here last year. So it's been along with the movie Torn, which is another doc. Mm-hmm. These are both films that they just agreed to hang on a whole year and book them a year later.
And let's not forget, we got some dinners to go to. You have to go to do your Netflix COVID test at some point. I did mine. They hand deliver it to you this year. It's a whole new thing. But like I said, it can when we were spitting in vials all the time, you know? Like, you have to hustle at a film festival. So this is just one more thing, I mean.
Jump over the hurdle. All right. Thanks a lot, Eric. Talk to you soon
again.
So
next week, we'll have a lot more to do.
We'll do a real wrap-up. Bye-bye.
Bye.